I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. The student debt crisis, the rising cost of college, the uneven recovery since the recession. In this hour, we talk finances with Sheila Bair, former chair of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC, and the new president of Washington College, a private liberal arts school on Maryland's Eastern Shore. We'll get her thoughts on what's driving tuition increases and her advice for millennials navigating the job market. Plus, inner-city students may struggle to make the transition to college. We'll hear about an initiative called George's Brigade that proposes a creative solution, group admission. And what is the value of liberal arts in an economy centered around science and technology? Sheila Bair, the new president of Washington College, on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're thinking, where's Dan? Let me just say, I'm a Dan Rodericks fan too. With his heart and his brains, this has been a program you want to tune to tap into the big issues and fun developments, to be connected to community. My intention is to build on that, to continue to invite interesting guests with fascinating stories to tell, and to invite you to be part of the conversation. I'm looking forward to getting to know you. I think we're going to have fun. Let's get started. Washington College is a private liberal arts college in Chestertown on Maryland's Eastern Shore. It's the 10th oldest college in America, founded in 1782. It has an undergraduate student body of approximately 1,450 students with a 12-to-1 ratio of students to faculty. It prides itself on offering more than 40 majors in academic programs. Its new president is former financial regulator Sheila Bair, and we'll speak with her this hour. Sheila Bair grew up in a small town in Kansas, the daughter of a surgeon and a nurse. She studied philosophy and law, got her start in 1981 as an aide to Kansas Senator Bob Dole. 10 days ago, Blair was installed as Washington College's first female president. She took over from interim president Jay Griswold, who stepped in and after former president Mitchell Reese left it. Head Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. This is President Bair's first foray into the field of education administration. Her career has been centered around finances. She served as chair of the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, under President Clinton, assistant secretary of the Treasury for Financial Markets under President Bush, and chair of the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, a major bank regulator under both President Bush and President Obama. She's also written several books, including her analysis of what went wrong in handling the financial crisis, called Bull by the Horns, Fighting to Save Main Street from Wall Street and Wall Street from Itself, published in 2012. She's also written several children's books about finance. Today, we'll ask Sheila Bair's take on the student loan crisis and the value of a liberal arts education in an economy that's focused on science and tech. We'll also ask her what went wrong in the worldwide financial crisis and whether she thinks the economy is back on track now. And we'll talk about a new program that she's hoping to put in place, making the transition to higher education easier for students from inner city schools. President Bair, welcome to Midday.
Thank you, Sheila. I'm happy to be here.
And we're so happy to have you. Of course, people know you as chair of the FDIC. That's where you were really high profile. And before that, these other financial regulatory jobs that I mentioned. What encouraged you to make this pivot?
Yeah, well, I think the opportunity to give back. You know, I'm getting into the late stages of my career. This may be my last job, and I as a member of the baby boomer generation, I just don't think we've done a very good job of being stewards of the economy or our financial system. I think we're leaving our kids with a very challenging job market. I don't want our legacy to be a lot of high levels of student debt, and we see that increasing. I think my generation has been too much, you know, we borrow from the future to pay for the needs of today, and that's manifested itself in how we fund education these days, too. And so I'd like to try to make my own contribution to fix some of that. And being at a small liberal arts college like Washington College, which is such an outstanding school and has such a rich history, and a wonderful baseline to build to do even greater things in terms of giving our students degrees that are not only meaningful and make them good citizens and socially responsible, but also have value in the job market, actively helping them get jobs, doing much more to raise scholarship funding so they can rely less on student debt. I think those are things that are very attractive to me that I would find very rewarding as I enter the later stages of my career.
Washington College is very different than the schools you yourself went to. You went to public University of Kansas, correct, for both undergrad and law school.
That's right.
Do you find that daunting?
Yeah, you know, so I grew up in a small rural town in southeast Kansas, and if you went to college, KU is kind of where you went. I think I really wasn't exposed to this other huge segment of our higher education system, which is a small liberal arts college. But I think it's wonderful, and I wish I had. I love the education I got at KU, but as an undergraduate, I think it would have been nice to have been in a smaller, more intimate school. My son just graduated from Swarthmore College, a similarly sized institution, and I think small liberal arts colleges that focus on undergraduate education, they are our specialty, they are our singular focus, with the small, student to faculty ratios, the small classes, a lot of counseling, and experiential learning. I think those are really, especially for undergraduates, I think that's just a very nice, nurturing educational environment that's right for a lot of kids. So if I had to do it over, as much as I love KU, I think for an undergraduate education, I wish I had pursued that. But now I think I'm very pleased to be leading a school that provides that kind of education and has such a wonderful history of doing it for 233 years. It's very exciting to me.
You focused in your first answer as well as in your inaugural address on student debt. Do you see a direct connection between what students are facing now and the financial crisis of 2008?
I do. I see a lot of parallels. I think, a lot of this is being driven by pursuit of very laudable social goals and government support for their social goals, because they are not as well thought out as they perhaps should be. Perversely, we're making the achievement of those goals, whether it was home ownership leading up to the subprime crisis or higher education today, we've been making it more expensive, and we're not giving thoughtful enough about who's borrowing and whether they can pay it back. So just as we had millions of borrowers ended up with mortgages they could not repay, I'm fearful that we're going down that same route with kids getting student loans that they will not have the income potential to repay, which is a terrible burden for them, and one they cannot discharge in bankruptcy, by the way, because of our bankruptcy laws. I also think both are being a drag on the economy. We still, our housing market, pockets of our housing market still have not recovered. For years, we had this drag on our economy because people were struggling to pay their mortgages and foregoing other sorts of consumer spending. You're seeing the same dynamic today with students. They graduate with large, by historical standards, very large debt loads, and so they forego buying a car, buying a house, starting a business until they can get those loans paid off, and it's a pretty good chunk of change. Because they forego those other types of financial transactions, it serves as a drag on the economy. The Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank did a very interesting study that shows how this impacts small business formation. Young entrepreneurs getting out of school, instead of starting a business, which requires borrowing, they go and work for a big corporation with a nice, safe job so they can have the stable paycheck to pay off their loans before they go out and take a little more risk with starting a business.
Assuming they can get a job.
And that's also right. It's a much tougher job environment as well. Mm-hmm. So there are, this is working hardship on the students, which is my primary concern, but we should all be concerned in terms of the greater impact it's having on our economy.
You're talking about things that people care a lot about, so let me tell our listeners that they can be part of this conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or long distance 1-866-661-9309. You can also send us an email to midday@wypr.org. Take us back to your thinking as the economy started to go into a tailspin. You're chair of one of the major banking regulatory agencies, the FDIC. When did you realize things were going off the rails?
Yeah, well, the FDIC was pretty early in sounding alarm bells. Actually, my history with this issue goes back to 2001 when I was at the Treasury, where we were seeing, and actually Baltimore was one of the hotbeds of this really abusive kinds of mortgage lending, where these high-risk mortgages with steep payment shocks. So, you know, you pay at one rate for a couple of years, and all of a sudden your payment would go really shoot up. They were adjustable rate. They weren't fixed rates, which is what most of us have. So we were seeing this already in pockets. Some Baltimore neighborhoods were one place where these types of high-risk abusive mortgages were being pushed. And when I was at Treasury, I worked with Ned Gramlich to try to get some standards in place around to get rid of some of these mortgages, or at least differentiate the more responsible mortgage originators from some of the people who were marketing these higher risk mortgages. And so we were not able to get political support for that, which was unfortunate. And then when I came back to the FDIC in 2006, I had been at UMass teaching in the interim. I was shocked to see that this type of really irresponsible mortgage lending had really gone mainstream, and that almost everybody was doing it. And that saddened me, because, you know, if we'd acted in 2001 with some standards, we could have protected, the more responsible mortgage originators who also got sucked into this because of the competitive problems. These high-risk mortgage originators were stealing market share from those that were trying to be more responsible, you know, requiring income documentation and affordable payments and things. So we were very early on this because I had a past history of it. And then our economic staff in particular were looking at this. And we went out and bought some data to see. Part of the problem was the mortgages were being sold off to investors in a process called securitization. So when a lender would originate the mortgage, or actually initiate the mortgage, instead of holding that mortgage on their books, which was the traditional way, they would package it with a lot of other mortgages and sell it off to investors. So we had to actually go out and buy a database that would tell us what these mortgages looked like that had been securitized. And we were appalled at what we saw. As I said, very high, very little income documentation, very high payments as a percentage of the borrower's income, which was not being documented, very steep payment resets after a few years. And it was just unbelievable. So we started sounding alarm bells very early. But it was hard getting people to believe that we had a problem, because mortgages traditionally had been a very safe form of lending. And when you did have problems in the residential mortgage market, it was generally more, it wasn't national, it was generally more, you know, isolated to specific geographic areas. So even though the data was very clear to us, we did have a lot of problems convincing others to move. And I think
when you say convincing others, you're talking about other
other
regulators.
Other regulators. Well, I it would have been nice if Congress had stepped in, but, you know, we had tried that in 2001 and that the industry that was the mortgage origination industry, the mortgage banking industry, was very influential on the Hill, and they pushed back on us too. So yes, we engaged with other regulators to tighten the lending standards for the subprime mortgages, which is where you were seeing the levels of distress and defaults were already going up. And it was hard. Yes, I go through this in some detail in my book. It was hard to get them to move. And then, of course, the Fed had the ability. The other problem was banks were only doing less than half of these originations. A lot of the originations were being done by non-banks, these independent mortgage brokers. And we had no jurisdiction over them as bank regulators. The Fed did. The Fed did have the power to write rules for everybody, but just refused to do it. They had refused to do it in 2001 as well, when that had been recommended to them by both the Treasury and the HUD, and the Housing Department of Housing and Urban Development, back when I was at Treasury earlier. So this was frustrating, and it did take, and I, to his credit, Ben Bernanke has said in retrospect that they should have moved earlier with mortgage lending standards.
He was chair of the Fed then.
He was a chair of the Fed at the time, yeah. But it is what it is, and this was unprecedented, and people were just didn't have their eyes as open as they should have. So It was unfortunate that it took so long, and then we had the same problem, and we saw that we were going to have millions of mortgages defaulting to try to get the mortgage services, who were the servicers,
right,
who were the people responsible. Right.
I want to talk to you more about that. We're going to take a quick break here, though, and I want to remind listeners they can be part of this conversation. Call 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Kast, and I'm speaking with Sheila Baer, president of Washington College. We're talking about some of her experiences as one of the main financial regulators during the financial crisis, but also about student debt. I'd like to pick up on that. We got an email from Craig in Chestertown who asks, how much does Washington College cost per year? Is the cost of facilities making it more expensive?
Well, yes, so it's a good question. So tuition, the all-in cost, tuition, room and board is about $55,000. Now that's consistent with what our peer institutions charge, but it's still a pretty good chunk of change, even for people who some would consider upper income. So it's important for students of need, for families who can't quite make that, to get some scholarship aid to the extent we can. So they will have to rely less on borrowing to meet those costs.
What is the picture?
I do think.
What is the picture of the debt load that Washington College students are taking on?
So we're a little higher than the national average, which concerns me. Where the national average is about $29,000 for graduates, we're at about $35,000, which is another reason where I would really like to try to get those debt levels down. We have some work to do. Even $29,000, I would like to see. Come down, but it's important.
Uh-huh. And how do you see bringing that down?
Well, I think first we need to hold the line on costs, and I do think Washington College has done a pretty good job. There have been tuition increases in the past, but we have generally been a little behind our peers in terms of we've not as aggressively raised our tuition as others. So that's first and foremost, we need to hold the line on costs, but also we need to increase scholarship funding so kids to pay for their school, so they can have scholarships, which do not need to be paid back, versus borrowing. If we can reduce, make the borrowing less and scholarship aid more, that should bring the student debt levels down. And that, of course, involves philanthropy and reaching out to our donors and expanding our donors to explain to them we are repurposing our philanthropy to focus very laser-like on scholarship funding. And so far, we've gotten an enormously positive response from our patrons, our alums, our donors who support the school. A good percentage of our budget does come from donations, and we'd like to expand that and, again, focus it on scholarship funding.
Want to remind our listeners that they can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Cassie is calling us from Baltimore. Cassie, welcome to the show.
Yes, good afternoon, President Baer, and congratulations on your new role.
Thank you.
I was interested to hear at the top of the hour the comment about a program to attract and I hope retain low-income and first-generation college goers to Washington College. I was hoping you could speak a little bit to that.
Yeah, so I'm very excited about this. It's called George's Brigade, and it is targeted at lower-income, first-generation students who, we find that for students in that cohort, it's very important. I think they can really benefit from kind of the small, intimate, supportive educational environment we provide. Nobody gets lost at Washington College. That's one of the advantages of a smaller school. But we would, it's a big culture change. It's different, if you're growing up in inner city Baltimore or Washington, D.C., coming to rural Chestertown is a big change. And then also you don't see a lot of students who have share your life's experiences. So being able to come with one or more friends to share that experience with people and can support, you can support each other. We think that's a very responsive. And then we will, to the issue of that a lot of these kids confront, and then also to meet their full financial needs and offer it as a package. So, you know, if you apply with one or more friends, we're going to review you as a group, and if you qualify, we're going to not only accept you as a group, but provide for your financial support as well, so you can be confident that both you and your friends can afford to go to school at Washington College. So I'm very excited about it.
President Bear, I cannot picture how you do a group admission.
Yeah. Well, we are working with a number of community groups to help identify students, and it's really up to them. They know who their friends are, we don't, but they can comply together and let us know that they are applying with each other.
How big a group?
We're going to start with 20 students total. So I'm assuming that we will group groups of 3 to 4. We will consider larger groups if they want to put that larger group together. But based on the initial response, which we found quite positive, we're anticipating groups of 3 to 4.
Have you admitted such a group yet?
No, we just started this, and we have not made any admissions decisions. So we're just now getting applications in. So this is a completely new program. We won't have our first group of George's Brigade until next fall.
Cassie, are you still with us?
And I'm very interested in hearing about this. I work at an organization called the College Bound Foundation here in Baltimore City. We work exclusively with...
This is Cassie Motz, right?
Yes.
Hey,
thank
welcome.
You.
Welcome to the show.
We work exclusively with Baltimore City public school students who are going to college, and our mission is to help them get to and through college. So I'd be interested in connecting offline, President Bear, with you or someone on your team.
We will definitely reach out to you, Cassie. Thanks for calling. Welcome that conversation, definitely.
President Burr, I'm aware of Cassie's group. I've also been involved to a small degree with the work of an organization based in Laurel, Maryland, called First Generation College Bound. And one of the things that confuses me about this approach of brigades is that I have the impression that many of these, at least First Generation College Bound, starts focusing, working with kids and families, kids who would be the first in their family to go to college,
right,
pretty early, like in junior high and certainly in high, working, helping them figure out how to fill out the financial disclosure form, how to apply, doesn't just start at the point when they're applying to college, but before that, how can if you're trying to help the transition of young people disadvantaged whose family history doesn't show them how to do this, how can George's Brigade do that?
Well, I think that's where we really need to partner with community groups. For the College Bound Foundation might be able to help us in terms of the public high school students they work with. All Stars, which is a group based in New York, but also works in some of our service areas, provide those types of counseling and support services. So I think we really need to partner with community groups who are on the ground in their communities who provide those types of services for kids, because you're right. And we also will certainly provide services and help to students and their families and how to apply, how to put the application together. We certainly do that as well, but I think working with not just the schools, but the community groups as well, I think is really essential.
This is Midday. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Sheila Bear, the new president of Washington College. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780 if you have some ideas for how the transition to college can be made more workable for inner city youth. 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Why is it called George's Brigade?
For our namesake, George Washington. We're very proud. George Washington actually, he explicitly gave us permission to use his name. He gave us 50 guineas to get us started. He was on our board of
50
governors.
Guineas, 50 guineas
50
is
guineas.
What?
It was about $20,000 back then. So that was real money for a public servant. So we're very proud, and we really emphasize good citizenship, integrity, honesty. Those are all the kinds of things that, we think our founding father stands for. And So we like to make that connection to our patron, our namesake, and that's where the name came from.
And where did the idea for George's Brigade come from? I mean, is anybody else or any other colleges elsewhere doing this?
I'll take credit for it. It was my idea. And actually, I had been discussing it with Elizabeth Warren, who's a good friend, and she was encouraging. And I also consulted with a number of community groups who I had worked with over the years at the FDIC and other government jobs. And then since that time, Elizabeth told me about a group called Posse, which does have a similar program. They're larger than we are. They work with larger universities and larger cohorts of students, but we've reached out to them and look forward to learning from them and seeing if we partner, if we can. It's the same idea, is to have the kids apply and come to the college or university with a social support network. And I think that's really important to making sure especially their first experience is a successful one, a positive one, and also with retention. And so I'm very excited about it. And I think it's going to be, like I said, the response we've gotten so far has been fabulous. And I think we'll easily fill the 20 slots, and we're gonna we have the resources that we will provide full financial need for those kids. And again, those two things, the social support plus the financial issues being addressed, are two keys to retention and making sure they have a successful graduation experience at our school.
Do you know what kind of results the Posse Foundation has had at other schools?
I believe it's been. I have not. I've reached out to them, and we are. We've scheduled a meeting, and we have certainly reviewed their materials and their website. And I believe it has been a very successful program. I know Elizabeth's hired two Posse graduates, which is why she was very high on the program.
Elizabeth Warren,
and,
Senator Warren.
We're learning more. Yeah, Senator Warren. Yes, and so we're very excited about it. And I think to the extent we can learn from them and partner with them, I would love that. It's what I can tell. I think they have dealt more with larger schools. More groups of 20 than, you know, which would be larger, too large for us. But I really look forward to reaching out to them and learning more about what they do.
We have Kelly calling us from Hunt Valley. Kelly, I understand you were a first generation, first in your family to go to college.
That's correct, yes.
And how did that work out?
It was an amazing opportunity. I was reliant on academic scholarships, grants, and things like that. But the biggest challenge for me getting to college wasn't so much the academic course load, because I had to be able to do those things to get there. It was acclimating to the social environment, because I came from a very poor family, and they weren't able to provide me with the resources of, you know, money to be part of a sorority or to have the luxuries of, you know, the really nice clothes or cars or things like that. And that was a huge challenge, not being able to go out, not being able to just, you know, go grab burgers someplace that wasn't on my meal plan, and adjusting to that environment.
Are you comfortable sharing with us what college you went to?
I did. I am. I went to Syracuse University in New York.
Uh-huh. President Baer, what about that? What about the fact that you can have some friends there, but you're still not going to feel like you fit into on a wealthy campus?
Well, I think I wouldn't call us a wealthy campus. I think we're a very diverse campus already. We pull from a broad geographic region. We have a lot of international students. Actually, about 11% are international. We draw throughout the country here, from the West Coast, from the South. So, and I think we are, we try to be, and with George's Brigade, we'll be even more so, diverse in every sense of the word. So we try very hard to do that. We also, by being a small school and having low student-to-faculty ratios, support services, counselors, student mentors, we try very hard to, you know, as I say, you don't get lost at Washington College. We stay connected with you. We want to stay connected with you. I wear flip-flops to the office frequently. I don't think you're going to find a lot of Gucci's at our campus. So it's not really that kind of an environment. And I would hope that, you know, I don't know if, I'd be interested in your views, Kelly, is about whether if you'd been able to apply with friends and have two or three friends going to the school with you, if that would have made a difference for you or led to a more successful and satisfying experience. But we're hoping, that will help as well. But I think our school, our students are great.
Since you, it's a good question. Please. Kelly, are you still with us?
I am.
You think, would that have made a difference if you had shown up on campus with a friend or two whom you already knew?
I think it would have. I think it would have had a major impact, in fact. And that's why I do think this sounds like a fabulous program, because that was a big problem, not having anyone there that I could relate to. And then finally right. finding someone a year later who had graduated from my high school, who was there, and being able to talk to them, just have mm-hmm. that conversation of, are you experiencing the same things? Right. How do you feel? And it really did make a difference. I mean, that one person really changed my view from freshman year through the rest of my college life.
That's good to hear. That's what our instincts told us, but that's a nice affirmation. That's helpful, Kelly. I appreciate your calling in.
Yeah, Kelly, I do too. Thank you. And I see that Joe Fisher, who heads the First Generation College Bound in Laurel that I discussed, Joe Fisher is on the line. Hey, Joe.
Hi. How you doing, President Beer?
Fine, Joe. How are you?
I'm
Sheila,
doing
please.
Great. Yeah,
we'll
Sheila.
Get everybody confused using Sheila and Sheila, but yes.
I really congratulate you on taking on this initiative.
Thank you.
I tell you, bringing in these low-income students. The question I have is, knowing that many of these low-income students experience many challenges causing them not to achieve their academic potential. I mean, we have a lot of raw potential out there. We've seen it over 26 years. We've seen the results of success of these kids go on. And in terms of the profile, the cohort that you're looking at, what type of academic profiles or what are they going to look like? Are you going to be, especially with many students, with many colleges
right.
talking about not considering SATs in terms of admitting
right.
these students to give them
right.
a chance? I would just want to know, what type of academic profile you are going to be looking for or requirements for the students for admissions.
Right. Well, we will use a flexible admissions criteria. Now, we will ask for SATs and GPAs, but those will not be determinative. And again, we at Washington College, U.S. News and World Report has called us an A-plus school for B students. And I like that appellation because we understand that, students have a lot of potential that may not necessarily be reflected in a grade point or a SAT score. And so we are very open-minded in our admissions policy. And the kind of education we provide is also, we have very good classroom experience, but there are alternatives to the classroom, too, in terms of experiential learning opportunities. We have something called Chesapeake Semester, where you're out on a boat for a semester learning about the Chesapeake Bay, learning about the history, the anthropology, the environmental concerns, the role in commerce. It's an enormously successful program. We have a very active, a lot of other environmental programs. We have the Rose Literary Center, a research center on American history. We have, for those interested in finance, we have Brown Advisory has a program where the kids actually manage their own fund. They went to Warren Buffett's shareholder meeting last year. So we provide lots of areas of ways of engagement and lots of enriching experiences that are outside the classroom. And so I think that those students are really the ones we want. The kids who make straight A's and have beautiful SAT scores, there will be lots of competition for them, and they will not have a problem. But it's the kids that still have the potential that maybe they're not reflected in, the most pristine grade point averages or SAT scores. Those are the kids we want and embrace and support. That's really who we're made for.
Joe,
we've got a few straight A students too, but I don't want to suggest that. But we're not narrow-mindedly focused on that cohort.
Joe, I appreciate your calling. President Baer, we're going to take another short break here.
Okay.
There are several callers lined up to talk to you. And if you would like to be one of those callers, give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We'll be back in just a bit. Welcome back to Midday. Sheila Cast here. I'm speaking with the new president of Washington College, Sheila Baer. And I'd like to go straight to a call from Lee in Easton, who's been holding for a while. Hello, Lee. Welcome to the show.
Hello, and Dr. Bear, welcome to the Eastern Shore.
Thank you.
I'm curious about your having a background in the finance industry. It occurs to me that one of the offshoots of the mortgage bubble was the run up of costs of housing costs.
Right.
You know, where our parents could buy houses for less than what we pay for a car now, and so forth. And I'm wondering if the ease of access to student loan funding is part of the factor in the cost of college education rising at a rate that's far ahead of what regular mm-hmm. inflation is. I've got a couple of family members that, you know, you can borrow for living expenses, you can borrow your housing expenses, you can borrow your tuition expenses, and I just think there's a flood of money that is, you know, chasing a limited supply of services, mm-hmm. and it's driving the cost of the services up, in my estimation. I'm interested in your feedback. I have to hang up, but I'll listen. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I think it is a factor. The New York Fed did an interesting study on this. I believe it came out in May. I'm sure you can find it on their website. It did suggest that, you know, our highly generous student loan programs in particular they've diluted financial discipline at schools and have led to an increase in tuition cost. I don't think that's the only factor, but I do think it is a factor. I think, you know, I don't want to suggest, I think the answer to that is just getting smarter, though, about how we provide financial aid to students wanting to go to college. At the national level, I think we should look more, have a better mix of grant versus debt financing. I think we need more accountability for schools. You know, our debt level is a little higher than I would like to see, but I would say at Washington College, our default rate is very low. It's one of the lowest in the country. So our students do pay their loans back and have the capacity to pay those loans back. You've seen tremendous abuses, though, of these college the federal student loan programs, especially in the for-profit sector. I think these for-profit schools account for about 12% of the students, but they're, you know, about 45% of the defaults. So that's because the kids they're focused on just getting the kids in for the revenue through student loans, and they're not focused as they should be on giving these kids an education that will land them a job where they can repay the loan. So we could get a lot more thoughtful about how we design federal aid programs. I also think federal regulations are part of the problem. When Senator Barbara Mikulski was at my inauguration last Saturday, she announced that she and Lamar Alexander, Republican senator from Tennessee, will be leading a joint effort to look at simplification of regulations that, especially for smaller schools, can really have a significant impact on cost. So I think those are all things that factor into it. And then I think for philanthropy, too, I would reach out to donors and suggest that, you know, lots of people like to build buildings and have their names on buildings. And gosh knows there's always a need for plant and equipment. And we need to build a new boathouse at Washington College, where we have a champion rowing team in a boathouse that's really quite aged and needs to be replaced. But so I don't want to suggest that all construction projects are bad, but I do think there's been a tendency of donors to be focused more on building buildings as opposed to providing scholarship funding. And if I was a donor, I would want my name on a scholarship fund, and that's going to be as lasting as any building and probably a lot more tangible in terms of the benefit you can provide.
I would like to underscore Lee's question. Lee is no longer on the phone, but I mean, it seems like a sort of a basic economics 101 that if the supply of money is practically unlimited, if families, young people are willing to take out these loans, that would lead to an increase in tuitions. It would ease the pressure on
right.
on
well, yes, I,
colleges.
I think it's well. I think that's part of it. I would also say though, a couple of things. Supply has expanded too, but it's mainly with these for-profit. So as demand has increased because it's easier to get financing through student loans. Supply increased too, especially on the for-profit side, and these schools were not serious about giving these kids an education. They were just, you know, interested in getting the money. So I think if the federal government had been a little smarter about imposing accountability with who was the schools that were benefiting from the student aid, I think that would have been would have been better, and I think they're trying to correct some of that. But no, that's absolutely right, that the economics of this did increase demand. But demand is also is increased because the economy is just more complex. Technology is replacing a lot of the unskilled jobs, which did not require a college degree. Those are being replaced by technology. So to navigate this labor market today, it's much more important to get a college education. So that factor by itself has also increased the demand for a college degree.
And that may be part of why we got an email from Alice in Frederick, who wants to know how you feel about the possibility of government-funded university for all Americans, such as the plan Senator Sanders proposes. Would this cause a massive influx of new students, in your opinion? And if so, are universities equipped to deal with that? What would be the pros and cons?
Yeah, so I think you need accountability. So, but before we start talking about spending even more money, and we spend a lot of money already, I think we need to get more thoughtful about what kind of education are we paying for. And just saying it's free for everyone doesn't help if the incentives on the part of the school to provide an education that will help the young person, the young graduate, have a meaningful, satisfying career, one that where they can contribute to the economy. If they're not getting that kind of education, then we have a problem. So I think you need to, and then also obviously you're favoring the public sector over privately funded schools if you do that, and I think that could probably hurt a lot of very good colleges, private colleges now, that have made wonderful contributions to our higher education system. So I think how that skews, how that impacts enrollment at private schools, if they're not getting free tuition but the public universities are, I think that's something else that hopefully the government would think through very carefully. I would err more on greater accountability. One thing that I've suggested, and I suggested that for years, is that schools should be responsible, at least those with very high default rates, should have to pay up. They should have to absorb some of the losses for those student defaults. I think if you made them take the financial responsibility, they would get a lot more focused on making sure their students graduate, and they graduate with degrees where they can get jobs to repay those student loans.
Let's turn to Martin in Middletown, who talks about a frustration that he had when he was an undergraduate. Welcome to the show, Martin.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a college graduate. I have a bachelor's degree from a public university in liberal arts. And I'm curious to know your thoughts on having intensive guidance counseling and career counseling coupled with your program.
Right.
My parents drilled into my head, go to college.
Right.
And I went, and it took me quite a while. And I took out all sorts of loans and hardships to do that. And I've got a huge diploma. And I'm unemployed now, and I'm feeling, wow, what good did this do me? And I was very disappointed in the lackingness of connecting education to the practical uses of that education. So if you could address that question, I would really appreciate it.
Well, let me say, first of all, I think the smaller schools where you can keep track of students better and engage with them on a more personal level, I think, are better equipped to do that. I also think it's important to help kids graduate in 4 years. I mean, your debt, if you're going to school for 6 years or longer to get your degree, obviously your debt load is going to be a lot greater. So helping making sure the kids have the support to graduate in 4 years is important. I think a liberal arts, I was a philosophy major and then I went to law school. I think, and a lot of famous people were philosophy majors, Carly Fiorina, among others. It taught me how to think. It taught me how to write. It gave me a moral compass. It helped me think logically and focus on goals. And so I think liberal arts degrees, even though it's not an occupational degree, and that's not what liberal arts colleges provide, and there are occupational vocational schools that can provide that kind of very specialized training in a particular occupation if that's what you want. But for a liberal arts college, I think what that teaches you is how to learn, how to adapt, how to navigate, how to understand your place in society, understand how other people think, people who may have different views than you do. It teaches you how to write, how to communicate, which is a highly valuable job skill. And we are known as the Writing College. We have a very strong writing program. You will learn how to write and write very effectively by the time you graduate from Washington College. We also have a very active career center. We are actively engaged in getting employers to come to the campus to interview. We actively market the value of a liberal arts college along the lines of what I'm saying today. And I think thoughtful employers do want to hire and value those with liberal arts educations. And it's our job to make sure that those employers connect with our school, come to our school, and recruit our students. It's not enough just to provide an education. We want to do that. We want to provide you a good education, but we also need to help you launch your first career or go to graduate school if that's what you want. Most of our students do want to start working, and bring employers to the campus who value a liberal arts education and make sure employers understand the value of a liberal arts degree.
Martin, I appreciate your call. President Baer, I want to ask you about the books you've written, in addition to Bull by the Horns, which is a very tough analysis of what went wrong in trying to fix the financial crisis. And you really take on some of your fellow regulators. But you've also published three children's books about finances. And I gather the most recent one is The Bullies of Wall Street, is about the financial crisis.
Right.
Why do you think you can talk to children about this, and how do you approach that?
Well, yeah. So Bullies was written for young adults. So teenagers, undergraduates in college, I think, would find it useful. Actually, I've gotten letters from a lot of adults who find it useful. It's a very basic explanation of what happened. It gets into a lot of the economics that we were talking about earlier, about how when you provide easy credit, it will increase demand, which will increase the cost of whatever it is you're buying, whether it's a college education or a house, and that can be self-defeating. So it gets into some of the basic economics of the crisis, but it also explains how the crisis impacted Main Street America. It tells vignettes that are based on, I fictionalized them, but they're based on, drawn from interviews that I conducted with families who were impacted by the crisis. Again, working with community groups to identify families who suffered job losses or foreclosures, school cutbacks. The first story is about a young man whose family lost their house, and they have to give up their dog. They have to take their dog to the kennel because the apartment where they're moving will not accept pets. And this happened. There were several press reports of this in Boston and other areas. So it explains the real-world impact, I think, to make it relevant to young people so they can understand the interface of the financial industry to their everyday lives and others like them. But I hope it's also a lesson in terms of what we did wrong. The baby boomer generation did wrong in terms of holding the leadership positions in financial services, holding the key regulatory positions, where we just did not do what we needed to do to keep this from happening.
President Baer, there's much more I'm sure we could talk about, and I hope we have a chance to sometime. I really appreciate your spending time with us today. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks, Sheila. Enjoyed being here.
And we also want to thank Racina Gourmet for lunch today. We weren't able to share it with Sheila Baer because she's in Chestertown, but Racina Gourmet has two locations, 2819 O'Donnell Street in Canton, 300 East Lombard, downtown. Racina offers a wide-ranging menu of sandwiches, salads, pasta dishes, soups, and desserts. We will be back tomorrow. I want to thank our listeners. Tomorrow at noon, we're going to talk about the federal grant that Baltimore has received to fight HIV. We'll hear from a doctor on the front lines of HIV/AIDS and from a community advocate who's using his own experiences being HIV positive to spread the word about prevention. That's tomorrow at noon on Midday. I hope you'll be back with us. I'm Sheila Cast.